An extreme, definitive, please don't ignore me word of warning before listening to this episode. The following story contains multiple swear words, even the big ones, including scenes and situations depicting violence, scatology, coprophagia, torture, and Geraldo Rivera. That last one was to lighten the mood, but seriously, this episode is intended to be as messed up as its subject matter. Listener discretion is advised, nay, demanded. No complaining about this one if you listen past this long intro. We have plenty of content suitable for people who don't want to hear about coprophagia, which means eating poo. You don't need to look it up, it means eating poo. Did we mention listener discretion is advised? We warned you. This is Ann Arbor Stories. I'm Richard. Dozens of cities tried, hundreds of lawmen failed. Ann Arbor was the only city in the world that could cage punk rock's most anarchic, violent, and revolting personality. He was more combustible than Jerry Lee Lewis, more punk than Sid Vicious, 10 times weirder than Marilyn Manson. Iggy Pop crossed with Charles Manson, the voice of Randy Macho Man Savage, with enough of a connection with serial killer John Wayne Gacy to develop a father-son bond. Public Animal Number One, the man, the infamous legend, G.G. Allin. The first time G.G. took a shit on stage was at the VFW in Peoria, Illinois, on July 31st, 1985. Defecation became a staple of his live shows, so much so that when Geraldo Rivera interviewed him on TV in 1993, it was one of the first questions he asked. Quote, "Why did you defecate in front of a live audience?" Geraldo asked. Gigi's response, quote, "My body is a rock and roll temple, and my flesh, blood, and body fluids are a communion to the people, whether they like it or not. My rock and roll isn't to entertain, but to annihilate." Gigi intentionally mentioned blood and body fluids. Crapping on stage was just one layer of the Gigi live show shit sandwich. All his front teeth were fake, smashed out years ago after repeated self-inflicted blows with microphones and his own fists. His head was crisscrossed with self-inflicted gashes. He often pissed on stage as well, regularly brawled with his audience, trading punches and kicks, dragging punks out of the crowd by their hair, and beating them on stage. He swung microphone stands and threw chairs into the audience. At a gig in a little classroom at NYU, Gigi unpeeled a banana and crammed it up his ass. When some of it wouldn't fit, he threw the remainders at the crowd, then licked his fingers clean. Gigi's shows rarely lasted more than a few songs before club owners cut the power or the police showed up. Crowds knew what to expect. Nobody went to a G.G. Allin show by accident. Gigi's brother and bandmate Merle once said, quote, "We never plan on finishing the whole tour. There's two reasons, prison or the hospital." Gigi spent plenty of time in the hospital, and claimed to have been arrested more than 50 times. But through all the blood, broken bones, shit, and violence, only one city was able to stop this nihilistic, musical tornado of destruction. Ann Arbor. Gigi was born Jesus Christ Allin in Lancaster, New Hampshire in 1956. He earned the nickname Gigi as a baby, given to him by his 3-year-old brother, who couldn't pronounce Jesus. Gigi got into music at an early age, fronting band after band, each more violent and extreme than the last. As the bands got crazier, so did Gigi, wild on booze, heroin, and any drug offered to him for free. That night at the Peoria VFW in 1985 was still early in Gigi Allin's career. He was a month shy of his 30th birthday and hustling to make a name for himself. He took a bus from Chicago to play the gig, paid next to nothing to sing in front of a crowd of a few hundred hardcore punks and straight-edge kids. He wore a satin robe that night, draped over a jockstrap with the words "Eat Me" on the codpiece, with an arrow pointing at his crotch. Gigi was nuts, but he was also a showman. On stage wasn't some accident or spur-of-the-moment idea that night. Gigi planned it. He ate a box of X-Lax hours before the show and had to clench as hard as he could not to prematurely erupt. When the set started and he did crap all over the stage, chaos broke out. The punks in the audience, many of them underage, lost their minds and ran. The old vets who looked after the VFW ran too, towards this maniac ruining their hall. They tore out of the kitchen and leapt over the bar to kick Gigi's ass. But when they got close, Gigi started scooping handfuls of liquidy poo off the stage and rubbing the filth on his nearly naked body. The smell was described as incredible. Hundreds of disgusted punks streamed out of the hall and into the parking lot while Gigi continued the show, yelling into his shit-encrusted microphone, tossing handfuls of poo at the remaining onlookers. Gigi beat a hasty retreat, climbing into a van and speeding into the night just as the cops arrived. Gigi got drunk and passed out in a sweltering, roach-infested apartment in the suburbs, taking the bus back to Chicago the next day. That's essentially every Gigi Allen show. Whether you saw Gigi and the Jabbers, or Gigi and the Scumfucks, Gigi and the Toilet Rockers, the Disappointments, or Gigi Allen and the Murder Junkies, it was Gigi mostly naked on stage, playing with his dick, crapping and or pissing on stage, punching fans, smashing himself in the face with the microphone, and oh yeah, singing. It was this Gigi Allen that showed up in Ann Arbor in April 1989. Gigi and his bandmates, the Disappointments, T. Ricky Insult and Big Bad Bob, crashed for a few nights at the apartment of Leslie Marie Morgan at 717 North 4th Avenue. Morgan was either a friend, groupie, or short-term girlfriend of Gigi's. They met a week before in Muskegon, and she offered him and his bandmates a free place to stay in Ann Arbor if they wanted to pass through. These details will become very important in a minute. On April 12, 1989, Gigi and the Disappointments played a gig at the University of Michigan. They didn't schedule the show. They barged into a snack bar slash theater called the Halfway Inn at East Quad and took over the stage during the East Quad Music Co-op's weekly open mic night, which usually featured acoustic guitar performances and poetry readings. Gigi and the Disappointments pushed everyone off stage and played, Gigi bashing his head and face with the microphone, covering himself and the stage in blood. Then he whipped out his penis and masturbated on stage before attacking booing members of the audience. He kicked a female University of Michigan student in the stomach and hit another with a chair. They played for about 15 minutes until the co-op kids killed the power and campus security swarmed the place. Gigi and the band fled into the night and a warrant was issued for his arrest. One count of indecent exposure and two counts of assault and battery. Ann Arbor's finest never found Gigi, who left town 2 days later, though the warrants remained active while the band toured the Midwest. This was good news for Gigi, who wanted to avoid jail time as long as possible so he could deliver on a promise made to Maximum Rock and Roll magazine earlier that year. Gigi wrote to the magazine, vowing to kill himself on stage on Halloween night that year. He didn't offer specifics, and most readers were skeptical that he'd actually go through with it, but Gigi seemed serious. The worry from his bandmates was that he'd take a few people with him. Gigi played Chicago in May and Columbus in June, and on September 9th, 1989, the car he was riding in was stopped by Secret Service agents on the south side of Chicago after he withdrew money from an ATM to attend a Rolling Stones concert in Wisconsin. Gigi was on the White House's radar after writing a letter to John Hinckley, the man who attempted to assassinate Ronald Reagan in 1981. Allen had a thing for convicts and serial killers. He wrote Hinckley because he was curious about the shooting. He had a fascination with John Wayne Gacy, who he corresponded with and eventually visited in the death house in Illinois, where Gacy was waiting to be executed after killing 33 young boys. Gigi spent 6 hours with Gacy, but he said it felt like 10 minutes. Quote, "He's a good guy. He's my father figure. I don't care what he did." The Secret Service ran Gigi's name and his warrants in Ann Arbor popped up. They transported him back to Ann Arbor, where Gigi faced a new criminal charge: assault with intent to do great bodily harm less than murder. The victim? Friend, groupie, or short-term girlfriend, Leslie Marie Morgan of 717 North 4th Avenue. Gigi pled not guilty to the misdemeanor assault and indecent exposure charges stemming from the open mic invasion, but demanded a preliminary investigation into Morgan's felony claims. Beating up college kids and pulling out his penis at West Quad were the least of Gigi's worries. The new felony charge brought a maximum sentence of 10 years in state prison and $5,000 fine. There are two sides to Morgan's story, which we'll review in a second. Know that the court reduced the charge to assault with a dangerous weapon in exchange for a plea of no contest. Gigi was sentenced to 18 months in state prison in Adrian and fined $2,000. Quote, I somehow feel that I'm getting tried for my reputation, not my crime, Gigi said afterward. Court documents stated that over the course of 6 days and five nights in that apartment on North 4th Avenue, a lot of bad things happened to Leslie Marie Morgan. The injuries described by the hospital physician were numerous. Cigarette burns on her face and the bottom of her feet, several cuts on both cheeks, cuts down the middle of her abdomen, deep cuts in a half moon shape around both breasts, and a 4-inch by 4-inch third degree burn on her left leg that required skin grafts. Morgan spent nearly 2 weeks in the hospital, including 5 days in intensive care. Gigi didn't dispute many of the injuries, but told a far different story. He said him and his bandmates arrived on Sunday night, April 9th, 3 days before the East Quad show. They drank hard and partied hard as Morgan's guests. Gigi said Morgan was in love with him, constantly asked him to marry her, and wanted to have sex with him and watch him masturbate all week. Gigi said she asked him to cut her clothes off with her own butterfly knife, then cut her flesh. Gigi said Morgan acted crazy, punching out windows and rolling in glass. The burn came one night when Morgan was passed out and Gigi tried to wake her up. Quote, I'll admit that using a lighter was not the smartest thing we should have used to wake her up. Morgan told police she was convinced she was going to die. Gigi said she only went to the cops because him and his bandmates wouldn't have a foursome. The proceedings dragged through September and into October, making it pretty clear that Gigi wouldn't make his Halloween date with Destiny. He was furious at police and the doubters who said he'd never actually kill himself on stage. Gigi was locked up on December 8, 1989, and spent the next 18 months in prison, keeping a daily journal of his experiences, which he'd later publish, while also corresponding for the first time with John Wayne Gacy. He was visited by friends and random fans, including a young Kurt Cobain, who was in Ann Arbor to play a show at the Blind Pig. Cobain idolized Gigi, so before Nirvana headed to its next stop on the 1990 Bleach tour, he and future Flaming Lips drummer Nathan Roberts stopped by the prison to say hi. Quote, after we told him who we were and that we were big fans, Gigi cursed and spit at us and kept yelling that we were just a couple of Kansas City f***ts who wanted their d*** sucked, Roberts said. Gigi was released on parole on March 26, 1991, and immediately said f*** you to his parole officer and left the state to record his next album and begin touring again. A young filmmaker from NYU named Todd Phillips contacted Gigi and asked him if he'd be interested in having a documentary made of him. Gigi agreed, and for the next few months, Phillips shot, hated, Gigi Allen and the Murder Junkies. The cult classic includes footage of Gigi on stage and in action, f***ing, cutting, brawling with fans, and pondering life and his ambitions. Quote, I have one pair of pants, a jacket, a shirt, pretty much everything I own will fit in a paper bag, Gigi said. I'm the type of person who always has to get out of town. The whole thing was supposed to last a year or two, but as the thing escalated, there was so much more to do. I said, f*** it, let's take over the world. The plan once again was to kill himself on stage on Halloween night. The grand finale caught on tape. Gigi and the Murder Junkies only completed a handful of shows that winter before things got out of hand on February 18th, 1992, a little less than a year after Gigi was released from prison. The band played a gig at the Cavity Club in Austin, Texas, and true to form, Gigi stripped naked but for a black dog collar and black gloves, bashed himself bloody with the microphone, crapped on stage, and threw it at the audience. Someone in the crowd took offense and maced him, the fumes filling the club and driving everyone for the doors in panic. When Austin police showed up, Gigi was covered in blood and shit and in obvious respiratory distress. He was taken to the hospital and booked, where his parole violation in Michigan popped up. Gigi was shackled and transported back to Washtenaw County, where he served the rest of his term in the state prison in Jackson. Gigi once again spent Halloween behind bars, and the voices of his doubters grew louder and louder, making him angrier and angrier. Gigi meticulously planned his comeback tour from prison. He wrote his brother Merle, sending him lyrics to new songs they'd include on the new album, booking shows and radio appearances, sketching t-shirt and sticker designs, and even negotiating a recording deal with punk label Enigma Records. On March 11th, 1993, Gigi completed his full sentence and readied for the Murder Junkies' spring-summer tour. Quote, this tour is going to be the most violent tour yet, Merle Allen said. We're basically out to get everybody in our f***ing way. Gigi and the Murder Junkies hit the ground running, playing shows from Boston to LA and every point in between. They returned to Michigan one more time, playing the Marquee in Detroit on June 6, 1993. These shows were rougher and rawer than before, with momentum building towards Halloween as the summer wore on. Would Gigi finally be able to make good on his word? The answer is no. Gigi did not kill himself on stage in 1993. 3 weeks after the gig in Detroit, Gigi played an all-ages show at the gas station in New York City, for which it seemed nobody was prepared. Gigi was already covered in blood and feces by the second song of the set when the owners cut the power to the place. An enraged Gigi Allen destroyed the club before taking to the streets still coated in blood and shit, leading a crowd of hundreds of punks down East 2nd Street, shouting and smashing their way through Manhattan. Gigi was elated at the carnage he had caused. He ended up in an apartment on Avenue B, drinking and doing a bunch of heroin to celebrate. He fell asleep on the floor, snoring loudly as everyone drank and did drugs long into the night. In the morning, everyone noticed that Gigi hadn't moved an inch. He was dead. Gigi's funeral was held back home in New Hampshire on July 3, 1993. For the wake, his bloated, unwashed, and makeup-free corpse was dressed in a leather jacket and jockstrap, with the words "Eat Me" written on the codpiece. In one hand, they jammed a microphone, and in the other, a bottle of Jim Beam. Gigi's new album played full blast on the stereo as mourners got hammered, did drugs, and messed with Gigi's body Weekend at Bernie style. They drew on him with Sharpies, pulled down his jockstrap and took pictures, shoved pills in his mouth, wrenched the bottle of Jim Beam from his arm and took big, sloppy swigs. Before closing the casket for good, Merle placed headphones over his brother's ears and pressed play on a Walkman, playing a copy of Gigi's Suicide Sessions album on a loop. They lowered Gigi into the ground next to his grandparents in St. Rose Cemetery. Gigi's tombstone bore the epitaph, "Live Fast Die." It quickly became a destination for curiosity seekers and hardcore fans, who frequently vandalized the grave with cigarette butts, liquor bottles, drugs, urine, and feces, until Gigi's mother had the headstone removed to make the grave harder to find. That was it. Gigi didn't get a chance to take himself out in front of a live audience on Halloween night. Instead, he died a typical rock star death. Gigi never forgot or forgave the Ann Arbor cops for taking years off his career, nor for twice killing his plans for a glorious public suicide. It took the little town of Ann Arbor to finally cage public animal number one, Gigi f***ing Allen. Ann Arbor Stories is presented by Rumble Pack Media in partnership with the Ann Arbor District Library. This episode was written and read by me, Rich Reddy, with recording and sound production by Brian Peters. Special thanks to my old college friend Nick Redler, who owned Gigi Allen's documentary and introduced me to the majesty that was Gigi back in college. Thanks as always to the Ann Arbor District Library and their amazing archive staff who continue to help us locate and research these stories. Please follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Ann Arbor Stories, or drop us a line at annarborstories@gmail.com. We'd love to hear what you thought of this episode or any of our previous stories. Thanks again for listening. 3 years in Michigan.